Welcome, everyone, to the Glengarry Historical Driving Tour 2021. This year, we are going virtual after close to 15 years of doing a driving tour in and around Glengarry County. The pandemic has pushed everyone into trying new things, and I think it's going to be fun. We're going to do this driving tour. You can go at your own pace. We have several speakers for seven different sites around Glengarry. So pick a day, pack a picnic, have some fun, and listen to the great history that Glengarry has to offer. Our first site is the Glengarry Pioneer Museum, close to my heart. It's in the quiet village of Dunvegan, North Glengarry. It's just a short distance south of the 417, almost exactly halfway between Ottawa and Montreal. It's an hour to Cornwall as well, so it's a perfect location to get to. The museum consists of 10 heritage log and timber frame buildings, which represent the life of settlers in this area during the 19th century. Buildings include two barns, a blacksmith shop, trapper's cabin, orange lodge, drive shed, one-room schoolhouse, and a hotel. The hotel, called the Star Inn, was built where it stands in the 1840s and was a regular stop along the stagecoach line. The other buildings were relocated to the museum from the Glengarry County area after the museum opened in 1962. Over the past 60 years, the museum has amassed an impressive collection of artifacts donated from the community, representing the life of Glengarrians from the early 1800s up to 1915. Artifacts include agricultural equipment, clothing and other textiles, photographs, paintings, furnishings, tools from various trades, and even oral histories. The earliest settlers in this part of North Glengarry were largely Gaelic-speaking Highland Scots, arriving in the late 1700s and early 1800s, with United Empire Loyalists, many of Scottish descent, settling in nearby South Glengarry. The waves of Scottish immigrants were enticed to settle as close as they could to these already established communities. As a result, much of this countryside is named after places in Scotland or the surnames of those who settled there: Dunvegan, Lochinvar, Lochiel, Skye, MacLeod Road, Stewart's Glen, and so on. Even the nearby town of Maxville got its name because there were so many Mick and Max that lived there. These strong Scottish roots are still alive in Glengarry today. It's not uncommon to hear bagpipes over the weekend as you wander the museum grounds. The village of Dunvegan was at its height from the 1830s to the early 20th century. A large log church was built in the 1840s, around the same time as the Star Inn, and a store on the opposite corner, which, if you are standing there now, has blue siding on it. Other businesses include a blacksmith, tinsmith, shoemaker, weaver, sawmill, cheese factory, and a schoolhouse. The Presbyterian Church had Gaelic church services into the 1930s. Many descendants who visit the museum still remember their grandparents speaking Gaelic. In the 1880s, the railway was constructed and went through an area south of Dunvegan. The areas immediately surrounding the railway line became more prosperous and marked the slow decline for villages like Dunvegan. As you stand on the porch of the Star Inn at the crossroads of Dunvegan, it's amazing to think of such a busy time in days gone by, a time where you could shop, have a carriage repaired, deliver homespun yarn to the weaver, and pick up a load of lumber from the sawmill. Today, Dunvegan is home to approximately 40 families, the Kenyon Presbyterian Church, Community Hall, and of course the museum. As a not-for-profit charitable organization, the Glengarry Pioneer Museum is supported by all levels of government and a strong community that cares for its heritage. The museum is a caretaker of the artifacts and their stories. offering glimpses of the past to future generations, interpreting these holdings through exhibits, events, group tours, and even themed education kits offered on loan to schools or other interested groups. The museum is open seasonally from the May long weekend until the end of September, often with additional special events happening around Halloween and Christmas. The grounds are spacious with many picnic tables and a large open-air pavilion. Staff are available for guided tours, or you may choose to explore at your own pace. Pack a picnic or pick up local takeout and spend an afternoon at the Glengarry Pioneer Museum. Contact the museum for the most up-to-date hours and list of programming. The address is Glengarry Pioneer Museum, 1645 County Road 30, Dunvegan, Ontario, K0C1J0. And you can phone us at 613-527-5230 or check out the website glengarrypioneermuseum.ca. Have a wonderful tour. Start in Mill Square.
G'day. My name is Dane, and I'd like to welcome you to Alexandria, the jewel of Far Eastern Ontario, a town of wonderful historic sites, as I hope we'll see just now. The big stone building here, now home to Priest's Mill Glassworks, is the old Alexandria Mill. It was a grist mill, a place where farmers could get their grain ground to flour, and it operated until the 1960s. It was built in 1905 and is actually the third mill on the site. The first two burned. The original mill was built in 1819 by the big bishop, the Reverend Alexander MacDonnell, parish priest of nearby St. Raffles and later first bishop of Upper Canada. It was surely a rustic log building with some sort of dam to hold back the Garry River, a water wheel to harness the river's power, and a pair of millstones to do the grinding. By no means a simple project to pull together in a backwoods setting. But it was soon up and running, the first mill in the area, the first industrial installation, and the building to put Alexandria on the map. There had been a few settlers in the area before 1819, but once there was a grist mill, the settlement, initially named Priest's Mill in the Big Bishop's honor, quickly expanded. Earlier, the only option for anyone in the Alexandria area wishing to have his grain ground before the Big Bishop's mill was built was to put a bag of grain on his shoulder and walk to the mill at Williamstown, built in the 1790s, or at Martintown, built 1801. The Big Bishop was big in stature, well over 6 feet tall, and big in ambition and accomplishment. He had arrived in St. Raffles in 1805 and soon set about building two of the greatest buildings of pioneer Ontario. The Bishop's House in St. Raffles, built 1808, still standing, and St. Raffles Church, built 1819 to 1826, burnt in 1970 and now a magnificent and carefully tended ruin. MacDonnell's parish was Little St. Raffles, but his vision was province-wide. He encouraged emigration from Scotland and Ireland, established parishes across Upper Canada, built churches and schools and mills, and advocated for immigrants in government circles in Canada and Great Britain. When Priest's Mill was renamed at the end of the 19th century, it was named Alexandria, again in honor of the Reverend Alexander MacDonnell. By whatever name, the little town got a big boost in 1844 with the arrival of D.A. Sandfield MacDonald, just 27 years old, already rich, and soon the top dog in town. He owned the grist mill and a sawmill and a general store and another general store at Lancaster. He owned most of the land where the town would grow, and an ashery making potash from hardwood ashes was the leading pioneer-era industry. Later, he was instrumental in bringing the railway to Alexandria, the Canada-Atlantic Railway, in 1882. The four Sandfield MacDonald brothers had grown up in St. Raffles in the era of the Big Bishop and seemed to have been infected with his vision that anything was possible, even in a backwoods settlement. All four brothers were successful, two of them spectacularly so. John Sandfield MacDonald was a leading lawyer and businessman in Cornwall, a member of Parliament for 26 years, Prime Minister of Canada from 1862 to 1864, and Premier of Ontario from 1867 to 1872. He spoke Gaelic, English, and French. His little brother, D.A. Sandfield MacDonald, was not only the leading businessman of Alexandria, but a contractor in the construction of canals, railways, roads, and waterworks on a continental scale. In the 1850s, at the same time he built the Montreal Waterworks, and with his brothers, the Montreal to Cornwall section of the Grand Trunk Railway, he converted the old gristmill in Alexandria to steam power and built a new steam-powered sawmill on Highway 43, where the fire station is now. D.A. was also an MP for 18 years and a cabinet minister and lieutenant governor of Ontario from 1875 to 1880. In 1892, he founded the Glengarry News, still owned by his descendants, while his fine house, the big yellow house, Garry Fen, still stands proud on the west end of Mill Square.
Drive north on Ottawa Street, then go west on Kenyon Street, Highway 43, to the fire station.
It was here, where the fire station now stands, that D.A. Sandfield MacDonald built his new steam-powered sawmill in the 1850s. Three decades later, in the early 1880s, that sawmill was taken over by a new arrival in Alexandria, J.T. Shell, born near Woodstock, Ontario, in Alexandria from 1882, and soon a leading local businessman. It was Shell's many metal and woodworking businesses, along with the sleigh and buggy building empire of Monroe and McIntosh, that created and sustained Alexandria's prosperous 1880 to 1920 industrial golden age. Shell partnered early on in Glengarry with D.M. McPherson, the cheese king, in the manufacture of cheese boxes and other wood products. Soon, with McPherson or without, he was operating sawmills at Alexandria, Dorney, Williamstown, and Monkland, as well as the foundry and woods products plants at the fire station site. He supplied the interior fittings for the Victoria Memorial Museum in Ottawa in 1911, and the new main post offices at Toronto and Winnipeg, among many other projects. Chances are that any fancy front porches still seen today on century-old Glengarry houses and the fine staircases and fancy woodwork within came out of J.T. Shell's workshops. He also built schools, houses, cheese factories, and businesses, and took on railway contracts, including in 1906, the Hawkesbury to Ottawa section of the Canadian Northern Railway. Shell was an Alexandria town councillor in the 1890s when, probably not coincidentally, the town got its new waterworks and electrical system. And from 1900 to 1908, he represented Glengarry in federal parliament. He died in 1916, and his factories and businesses all disappeared in surprisingly short order. Today, there is not so much as a street name to honor his remarkable accomplishments.
Go east on Kenyon Street to Main, then north to St. George Street and turn east.
The corner of Main Street and St. George was, for at least two generations of Alexandrians, the M&M Corner, the site of the five factory buildings of the Monroe and McIntosh Sleigh and Carriage Company, the place where the buggy from Glengarry and a host of other horse-drawn vehicles were manufactured through the glory years of the horse and buggy era, 1880 to 1920. At its peak before the First World War, M&M produced more than 10,000 sleighs and carriages a year for markets across Canada, in the U.S., and overseas. Hugh Munro, a blacksmith by trade, and John D. McIntosh, a wheelwright, were cousins and farm boys from Glengarry, Monroe from west of Glenroy, McIntosh from Apple Hill. They began working together in the 1870s, and in the mid-1880s, with business humming and vast new markets available via Alexandria's new railway connection, they built that complex of factories on the M&M corner. McIntosh, quiet by nature, managed the manufacturing side of the business, while the outgoing Monroe was the company's traveling super salesman. There were separate factories for woodworking, metal, upholstery, and shipping. M&M built sleighs in summer and buggies in winter, always ready for the coming season. New vehicles were carted to Alexandria train station and loaded into waiting boxcars. More M&M products were shipped from Alexandria station than all other freight combined. The factories employed more than 200, and with the huge quantities of wood bought from area farmers, brought prosperity to Alexandria and surrounding Glengarry County. Now, nor should we forget that the horse and buggy brought a revolution to transportation in the late 19th century. Large numbers of people, for the first time, could use their own vehicles to go where they wanted, when they wanted. It's a freedom we associate with the automobile, but it began with the horse and buggy. Both Monroe and McIntosh were active in public life, especially Monroe. Both were on Alexandria Town Council. Monroe also Reeve and Mayor, and two-term member of Ontario Parliament. Both contributed generously to the construction of the church on the hill, and both were among the early backers of the Glengarry News. Alas, in the 1920s, the growing popularity of the automobile undermined M&M's success. McIntosh died young of kidney disease, and neither partner had heirs who might have moved the company forward. McIntosh had no children, Monroe a daughter who married a dentist and moved to Edmonton. The five-building factory complex on the M&M corner was idle by 1930, torn down by 1938.
Proceed east on St. George Street.
Monroe and McIntosh both lived on St. George Street East, just steps from their factories, Monroe at 18 and McIntosh at 25. Both homes are still there. Notice the new blue plaques on the buildings, noting their celebrated former residents.
Go east on St. George to Bishop Street and head north.
The big factory on Bishop Street near the tracks is Alltech Biotechnology, a manufacturer of agricultural nutrients. The building was built in 1952 and operated 1952 to 1999 by Carnation Milk.
Turn west on McDougall Street, beside the tracks, to Alexandria Train Station.
Of course, there have been many factories in Alexandria over the years, some big, some small, manufacturing all manner of things, rail cars, food trucks, furniture, bread, cheese, clothes, shoes, stable litter, windows, you name it. Here at the station in former times were at least two factories, those of Alexandria Wood Pipe, which made pipes of wire-wrapped elm planks from 1910 to 1935. Alexander John de Lobinière MacDonald was the manager. And Alexandria Wood Products, Joseph Choquette, proprietor, which made hockey sticks in the 1930s and 1940s for the Montreal Canadiens, Boston Bruins, and other NHL teams.
Go west on McDougall to Maine, turn north, and go over the tracks to the big Alexandria Molding Building on the west side.
Alexandria Molding is the biggest company ever to operate out of Alexandria. It employs some 400 people here in town and another 600 at a series of manufacturing and distribution centers across the U.S. and Canada. It makes moldings, door frames, railings, columns, paneling, and other products of pine, hardwood, and wood composite that are sold in lumber yards and retail chain stores across the continent. The company was founded as a builder's supply by Roland Cholette in the early 1940s. It turned to windows and doors in the later 1940s as Alexandria Sash and Door, then added moldings in the early 1950s and grew from there. Alexandria remains Alexandria Molding's East Coast hub with this giant 220,000 square foot distribution center, plus a manufacturing plant and the company's kilns just behind it, and another factory on McDonald Boulevard in the town's industrial park. There is also a warehouse on Sandfield Street in the southwest corner of town, near where the company got its start 80 years ago. Alexandria Molding's West Coast Manufacturing and Distribution Center is in Moxie, Washington, interestingly a town settled by French Canadians in the latter 19th and early 20th centuries. There are also distribution centers in La Porte, Indiana, and Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Hardwood manufacturing is centered at Bradford, Ontario, north of Toronto, a town like Alexandria with a long history of lumbering and woodworking. That's our little tour. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you'll come back to Alexandria or maybe come and live in wonderful little Alexandria. Thanks very much.
Welcome to MacDonnell House, the new home of the Glengarry County Archives. I'm Alan MacDonald, the County Archivist, and I'd like to tell you about this stately Georgian-style building. It's Alexandria's oldest, dating from the early 1820s, and was built for Colonel Angus MacDonnell, a nephew of Bishop MacDonnell, the first Catholic Bishop of Upper Canada. Colonel Angus owned Lot 37 in the Second of Lochiel, which was to become today's Alexandria. Now, during the building's construction, the limestone making up its 2-foot walls was drawn by teams of horses from a quarry just a mile and a half south of here. When completed, the building dominated the village and would do so for decades. When taking in the building's exterior, you'll be struck by two features. The first one is that initially the building faced away from Kenyon Street. Secondly, the building then and now is not positioned parallel to Kenyon Street. Why is that the case? Well, the reason is that MacDonnell House was here decades before Alexandria streets were laid out. Now, a word about the archives. The County Archives is the largest repository of historical records in Eastern Ontario and contains the foremost collection of history about Glengarry, bar none. Founded in 2013, the Archives is the official repository for the records of both municipalities, North and South Glengarry, and is mandated to preserve the memorabilia of individuals, organizations, and clubs from the settlement period to the present. If you explore its 265 collections, you'll be drawn to the rich and diverse array of Glengarryana. Examples being the local newspaper, the local hospital, the Highland Games, and the Williamstown Fair. Now, in 2019, an opportunity arose to secure this building for the archives. The call went out, the community responded, as did the municipalities, and MacDonnell House was purchased and completely renovated. Now it will stand for future generations as the permanent home of Glengarry's history. Now, when COVID runs its course, I would invite you to drop by and discover where Ontario began.
Hello. Your guide for the tour of Williamstown is David Anderson. For the past 31 years, he and his family have been licensed tenants at the Bethune Thompson House, living there full time. In normal times, they give a tour of the inside of the lovely house, but with COVID, we cannot. The small back extension to the south is the oldest domestic structure in Ontario, built by Peter Ferguson, an early loyalist. Built in 1784 in the poteau sur sol style of timber frame, where the logs stand vertically together rather than horizontally. In 1784 was the first year of settlement of refugee loyalist families coming north from the rebellious 13 colonies. Prior to this settlement, the area was called the Wasteland of the Crown. Where we are in eastern Ontario was part of the colony of Quebec. For the first 8 years after 1784, this was Quebec. All the land documents of that era refer to Williamstown, Lower Canada. For researchers looking for those first 8 years of the history, the documents are in Montreal. The main part of the house was added in 1804 by Reverend John Bethune, the first Church of Scotland minister in Upper Canada. He went on to have auspicious descent, in that there is an unbroken line of medical doctors and clergymen down to the well-known Dr. Norman Bethune of China fame. We are fond of saying Dr. Bethune is the best-known Canadian in the world because every Chinese citizen knows who Dr. Bethune was. He did not live in the house, but Reverend John Bethune was the great-great-grandfather of Dr. Bethune, who grew up in Gravenhurst in central Ontario. The Thompson name comes from David Thompson, a cartographer, mapmaker, and explorer who worked for the Northwest Company in the historic fur trade of Canada. He lived in the house from 1815 to 1836. He is widely accepted as the world's greatest mapmaker who ever lived. The house is owned and protected by the Ontario Heritage Trust in Toronto. We give tours through the summer, easily obtained by ringing the doorbell and saying that you love David Thompson. We cannot do any structural changes to the Heritage Trust maintains the building. Being the oldest house in Ontario, the fabric of it is quite precious. Outside the back door, there's a large cast iron pot. When Mr. Thompson farmed here during his retirement, he had 24 kettle potashery. Branches and bark from clearing of the land were burned to produce ashes. The ashes were leached in barrels, then evaporated and the resulting solution in a large iron pot on a tripod over the fire. This left a white residue called potash, potassium carbonate, which often was used to make soap and further dried to create pearl ash, a chemical that was exported to England for bleaching cotton and wool. Continue walking along the road past the original carriage shed on your right. The inner windows of the house are original, but the outer storm windows are Victorian. You can see the striations in the inner window. They are crown glass, spun in a disc, then cut into panes. The property was sold to the McLennan Robertson family in 1834, and they kept it for over 100 years. The third part of the house, with its sun porch, is a 1913 rebuild of the original end of the main house. On the front lawn, there is a blue marker sign from the Ontario Heritage Trust, discussing the history of the house. We recommend you take the time to read it. Looking towards the house, you can see the original Georgian door. The unusual roof is made of tin-dipped copper sheets. The sheets are crimped around each one, so the nails are hidden. Everything is on an angle to offset the nail placement in the underlying boards. Peter Ferguson had 9 children living in the original house, while the Reverend John Bethune had 10 children living in the main house. One of the Bethune descendants was the noted Canadian actor Christopher Plummer. We'll now walk to the St. Andrew's United Church. From the driveway of the Bethune Thompson House, turn left on John Street. You will be walking across the edge of the Raisin River, originally called Rivière aux Raisins, because before settlement, the area was logged by the French from Lower Canada. This river flows into the St. Lawrence River at Lancaster and is the only river in Ontario to do so. The early Scottish settlers called the river Awangu, or Black River in Gaelic. This was because of the giant elm and willow trees formed a crown across the river, creating a dense shade. It is said that little boys could scurry across the tops of those trees from one side to the other. Boat passage between Lancaster and Williamstown was spent in a dappled tunnel filled with bird songs. The site of Williamstown was part of the land grant from the Crown to Sir John Johnson. Across the river, you can see his manor house. He was a British loyalist and military leader during the American Revolution. A wealthy landowner with properties in Lower Canada and the United States, he built the manor house between 1784 and 1792 and named the village after his father, Sir William. At the time, Sir John Johnson was the second largest landholder in North America after William Penn. At the curve of the road is the site of the first mill in the river built by Sir John Johnson. This mill was situated at the bend of the river, so there is quite a large mill pond where the dam was in place. On this side of the river was a grist mill, and on the other side was the sawmill. In 1903, the grist mill became a steam-driven carding mill. A few years later, the Ogilvy Mill was built in Montreal, centralizing the carding mill process and putting the small local mills out of business. You can still see remnants of the mill in the river. Further upriver, there were mills in Martinstown and St. Andrews. The Martinstown grist mill still exists and is being made into a museum. Still existing here is one building from the time when the mill was used for carding fabric. It is a wooden building with a blue roof right across the road from New Life Mills. There is another blue historical plaque for more information. Continue walking to Church Street and St. Andrew's United Church. Originally built as the log church in 1787 by the Reverend John Bethune, the work on the present stone church was started in early 1812, but was interrupted by the War of 1812 and finished in 1818. The bell in the steeple was inscribed as donated by Sir Alexander Mackenzie of the Northwest Company. There are three historic plaques here, one for the church cemetery, which reads, "Tread softly, stranger, reverently draw near. The vanguard of a nation slumbers here." A second refers to the church and the bell and the longevity of the ministers. The final plaque refers to Duncan Cameron, who was the Northwest Company enforcer at the time of the Red River Massacre, also known as the Selkirk Massacre. There are many significant graves in the cemetery if you have time to explore. In the church itself, please admire the beautiful arched Palladian windows. The frames are original, and most of the glass is original as well. With the balconies, the church could seat 800 people. Exiting the church, turn right and go to the first street on the left, Warren Street. This is one of the four streets in the world named after Admiral Sir Peter Warren. He was the uncle of Sir William Johnson of New York. Irish by birth, he oversaw the British forces at the taking of Louisbourg. Eventually, he had several thousand acres of land near Albany, New York, on the Hudson River. He brought his nephew, William Johnson, out to North America to clear and manage that land. Continued down Warren Street to the site of the oldest continuous agricultural fair in Canada. An early map of Williamstown from the time of when Sir John Johnson was leasing all the village lots shows that many of the properties still have the same family names. The current fairground was entitled Fair Place of Williamstown, and the fair recently celebrated its 200th anniversary. With exhibits, programs, competitions, and entertainment representing the rural agricultural way of life, thousands of people yearly attend this heritage fair with its family-friendly atmosphere. The current use of the land is under a codicil that if Williamstown ever ceases to have an agricultural fair, the land must be reverted to the current Johnson Baronet of New York, Sir Guy Johnson, who lives in England. We keep in touch with the family. The original fair was held in 1818. For 4 years prior to that, the Highland Society of Canada used the land for their events. That society was incorporated in St. Raffles by William McGilvery of the Northwest Company and Bishop MacDonnell. They met in St. Raffles on a stormy winter day to incorporate the society. McGilvery brought the charter of the society from the Highland Society of London. Continue around the corner onto Bethune Avenue. Across the river is St. Mary's Catholic Church. The pioneer settlements of Glengarry were church-oriented, and Williamstown was originally affiliated with the Protestant Church of Scotland. St. Mary's was built in 1847 as a mission station for the Catholic Church at St. Raffles. St. Mary's has a remarkable stained glass window dedicated to the 8 Canadian martyrs. It is a sight to behold, with daylight coming into it, showing the actual massacre of the Jesuits by the Iroquois at Saint-Marie-aux-Irons in Midland, Ontario. In 1930, those martyrs were elevated to sainthood. We are ending our tour now at the Glengarry Nor'westers Loyalist Museum. This brief introduction to Williamstown was created to whet your appetite for more information. Consider returning to spend more time exploring this fascinating historical town. Please continue your journey with the tour of the museum.
Hi, my name is Kaylee Goodfellow-Thera, and I'm the curator at the Glengarry Nor'westers and Loyalist Museum here in Williamstown. Nestled on the north bank of the Raisin River in Williamstown lies the Glengarry Nor'westers and Loyalist Museum, which houses artifacts from the area's storied past and depicts the various narratives that shaped South Glengarry over the years. The building itself is a two-story Georgian-style structure made of brick. The grounds were donated by Sir John Johnson for the purpose of education in the village. The current brick building, built in 1862, replaced the previous primitive schoolhouse and operated until 1963. The names of the former students are etched in the brick, many dating back to the 19th century. In 1967, the building was converted into the museum. The east half of the first floor of the museum houses the Williamstown Room, where temporary exhibits on local history or art are mounted each season. The west half of the first floor is home to the newly redesigned permanent Loyalist exhibit, which depicts the journey of the individuals who fled their homes in the Mohawk Valley during the Revolutionary War and settled in the area, led by Sir John Johnson, son of William Johnson, after whom the village of Williamstown is named. The predominantly Scottish settlers were soon joined by more Scottish families from the Highlands brought over by Bishop MacDonnell. These combined waves of immigration served to form the basis of the rich Scottish culture in the area, with the name Glengarry itself being brought over from the Highlands in memories of the land they left. The story of these Scotch loyalists and their legacies is depicted through original artifacts and allows visitors to glimpse life as experienced in Upper Canada in the late 18th and 19th century. Also displayed are scenes following initial settlement, such as Victorian-era Glengarry, schoolhouse days, and artifacts from local Glengarians who fought in the World Wars. A portion of the second floor has been converted into an artifact room and office where cataloging and research take place. The rest of the floor, however, is open to the public and houses the permanent Nor'westers exhibit, which depicts the history of the Northwest Company. Founded in 1779, the Northwest Company was made up of smaller, mainly Scottish trading interests based out of Montreal and would become the biggest competitor of the Hudson's Bay Company until 1821, when the two forces amalgamated. Unlike the HBC, the Nor'westers were critical in the exploration of Canada's interior and paired trade and commerce with expeditions and surveying. Upon entering the exhibit, visitors are immediately drawn to the formidable 26-foot birchbark canoe that dominates the room. Commissioned by the museum for its opening in 1967, this canoe was made by the late and great canoe builder Caesar Nawashus of the Atikamekw. Also on display are various original and reproduction trade goods of both European and indigenous make from the 18th and 19th centuries. Why, one might ask, would there be a Northwest Company-centered exhibit in Williamstown, so far from the posts and forests that the traders inhabited on their wintry wilderness sojourns? Many of the partners of the Northwest Company actually had strong ties to Glengarry, either being from here or retiring to the area later in life. The proximity to Montreal and both the St. Lawrence and Raisin Rivers made travel to the area easy, and the Scots communities were particularly appealing to the Scottish traders. Northwest Company partner and famed Canadian explorer David Thompson spent what he deemed as the happiest years of his life in the village of Williamstown. Also highlighted in the exhibit is explorer Sir Alexander Mackenzie, who was a patron of the area and frequent visitor to his family that resided here. The museum holds a well-rounded collection of Sir Alexander Mackenzie artifacts, including his compass case and a family Bible inscribed in his very own hand. The museum is honored to enact its mandate of preserving the area's history and sharing it with the public and future generations to come. In addition to its permanent exhibits, the museum hosts a range of extra exhibits and activities. Guided tours are available for both individuals and groups and can be booked by contacting us at the museum. The grounds and Williamstown room are also available to be booked by interested individuals and organizations. Due to the restrictions, the museum has been closed. We can't wait to welcome you back to the museum, and we look forward to seeing you as soon as possible when things can resume normally. Thank you.
Good day. Your next stop is the Peanut Line. If you go out of the museum and turn right, walk approximately 300 meters, you will come to the point where the old peanut line used to cross the Raisin River. Now, the peanut line really is two stories. Firstly, the story of why it was built, and secondly, the story about the man who built it. The peanut line was built because Cornwall was expanding at the end of the 19th century. Business was picking up, and the businesses in Cornwall felt that they were being held hostage by the Grand Trunk Railway that ran the only rail service in town at that point. So the Chamber of Commerce got in touch with the Canadian Pacific Railroad and said, "How can you help us?" In 1912, it was decided that the Glengarry and Stormont Railway Company would be formed, and it was duly incorporated. And the understanding was that this would become a feeder line from the main Canadian Pacific line, leaving at St. Polycarp and traveling through South Glengarry to Cornwall. In 1913, the funding was in place and construction began on the Peanut Line. The line itself was 46 kilometers long and would provide South Glengarry with five railway stations to enable the movement of agricultural products and people more easily. The first stop after St. Polycarp was Bridge End. The next was North Lancaster. The next was Glen Gordon, where the line crossed the Highway 34, or as it was called then, the Military Road. The next stop was Williamstown. And the final stop before Cornwall was Glenbrook. The terminus in Cornwall was at the location of Pitt and 6th, roughly where Giant Tiger is right now on Pitt Street. And just across the road at Sydney and Adolphus were the freight sheds for the railway line. With the financing in place, construction began in 1913. And it was declared completed in November of 1914 with a celebratory lunch in Williamstown. On the 24th of May, 1915, the first train traveled with passengers through to Cornwall. And at the same time, the Canadian Pacific took a 99-year lease on the Peanut Line. There were great advantages to Glengarry in this particular line because now they had alternates to just Bainesville, Lancaster, and Somerstown to get their goods to market through that central part of the Charlottenburg and Lancaster. Also, the high school in Williamstown benefited greatly from the construction of the Peanut Line, in that students were able to travel and stay at the school. The line operated with passengers until 1952, and the importance of this line with the creation of the 401 declined quite rapidly. In 1969, the Cornwall station was closed, and the track, the end of the track was moved east to where the freight sheds were. In 1987, the final indignities occurred to the Peanut Line, not one, but two. The first in February of that year, the freight sheds were all burned down. In November of that year, following the paving of the of Boundary Road between Cornwall and Charlottenburg, a truck loaded with gravel, traveling more or less at full speed down the paved road, collided with the locomotive and knocked it over. And that was the last time a train ran on the Peanut Line. In 1993, Courtauld was closed, and CP, Canadian Pacific, decided to abandon the Cornwall subdivision. In 1998, the track was removed, and in 2004, the 401 was leveled out, and the bridge over the Peanut Line was removed. The last traces were gone. So at this point, I would say, enjoy the Peanut Line. It is now a great recreation facility. Now, what about the guy who built the Peanut Line? Chilian Hervey was born of Canadian parents, educated in the United States, and as a young man went off and fought in the American-Mexican War. He returned to Canada, determined to get into the railway construction business. He was or had been trained as an engineer. Having completed the relatively simple task of building the Peanut Line, and the First World War had also been declared, Chilian was hired by the Canadian Pacific Railway, who in turn had been approached by the Government of Canada to ask them to form a corps of railway troops. Chilian Hervey was immediately promoted to major and put in charge of the CP Corps of Volunteers, who would become the nucleus of the Canadian Railway Troops. He moved immediately with his men to France, and they became specialists at the creation of the light 60-millimeter railways that were used to replace the roads and move supplies and ammunition up the line and casualties back down the line. Harvey rose very quickly to become a colonel and in charge of yet more railway personnel. And he distinguished himself on two occasions with his railway troops. The first was in 1917, after the Canadian attack, or the Allied attack, had pretty much stalled at Arras. Harvey was able to hold a German advance with his machine gun troops, with his railway troops who'd been armed with machine guns, and until such times as regular infantry were able to come up and relieve him. This happened again in March of 1918, when the Germans made their great thrust of that year. The Allies were driven back, and again, the railway troops who found themselves at the front constructing new railways similarly were armed with machine guns and kept the Germans at bay until, again, they were relieved, this time by the New Zealand Division. For this, Harvey was recognized and decorated by King George V with the Distinguished Service Order, which was the highest gallantry award available to officers at the time. Not only was his skill in battle recognized, but he was also brought back to the War Office in London to oversee all railway developments. And with this went the title of Brigadier. So the man who built the Peanut Line had a very satisfactory wartime career and went on to stand for Parliament and be defeated a couple of times in Glengarry. But he spent the rest of his life living in the Williamstown area. I would encourage you to enjoy the Peanut Line. It is now a recreational facility, and it stretches all the way from St. Polycarp to Cornwall. Thank you.
Cooper Marsh is truly a gem in the Crown of Eastern Ontario conservation areas. Many thousands of visitors experience the wonders of this wetland every year. Nestled on the picturesque banks of Lake St. Francis, 3 kilometers west of Lancaster and 18 kilometers east of Cornwall, Cooper Marsh Conservation Area is the proud legacy of the late Mr. William Cooper Sr., a past chair of the Raisin Region Conservation Authority, and a former municipal councillor of Charlottenburg Township, now known as South Glengarry. This cherished wetland, part of the larger Charlottenburg Marsh, is designated a provincially significant Class 1 wetland in Ontario. In 1997, the Raisin Region Conservation Authority, who owns the marsh, partnered with the Cooper Marsh Conservators, a registered charity composed of volunteers, whose main aim is to actively help preserve, protect, restore, and maintain this natural area for present and future generations. Cooper Marsh is a year-round destination of choice with free admission. It's very popular with families, hikers, birders, wildlife photographers, and outdoor enthusiasts of all ages who visit from throughout eastern Ontario, southwestern Quebec, and beyond. Keen to explore the flora and fauna of the marsh and its isolated ponds, visitors have access to 12 kilometers of wetland trails that include 1 kilometer of fully accessible boardwalk. Viewing platforms and blinds are also available to survey the more than 200 species of birds that call Cooper Marsh their home for the warmer part of the year. During the pandemic, 2-meter distancing must be observed throughout the marsh. Wetland birds known to breed at Cooper Marsh include osprey, American bittern, Virginia rail, sora, green heron, wood duck, pied-billed grebe, black-crowned night heron, sandhill cranes, and the rare least bittern. The marsh also contains a wide variety of species of amphibians and reptiles, including American toads, spring peepers, leopard frogs, painted and snapping turtles, and more. As a center for wetland education, Cooper Marsh encourages youth to join one of its many educational programs run by the Conservation Authority or the St. Lawrence River Institute of Environmental Sciences. Following the end of the current pandemic, specially arranged educational tours led by the staff of the Raisin Region Conservation Authority can also be booked. The Cooper Marsh Visitor Center, which is currently closed because of the pandemic, is available as an interpretive and educational center for visitors and students alike. It is normally open from April through October. Knowledgeable volunteers from the Cornwall and Area Birding Club, conservators, as well as trained summer students act as interpreters and are available to provide information and answer questions. The center features local wildlife displays, videos, and information on the birds, plants, and wildlife typically found in Cooper Marsh. A new Zoom camera was recently installed to enable close-up, large-screen viewing of osprey and birds in and around the new pond south of the center. 5 viewing blinds and 3 viewing platforms facilitate wildlife viewing. At any given time, Cooper Marsh Conservators and the Raisin Region Conservation Authority are working on a variety of projects to protect and enhance Cooper Marsh plant life and its wetland wildlife inhabitants, as well as improve upon the wetland experience for our visitors. The marsh is known for its many unique wildflowers, including the Canada lily and cardinal flower. The Conservators Wildflower Group, with its nursery and garden volunteer team, was established by Dr. Philip Fry in 2016 when he donated much of his personal wildflower collection to Cooper Marsh. Volunteer members of the Wildflower Group propagate wildflowers in the nursery and plant them in strategic locations throughout the marsh. As a result, wildflower and pollinator populations are enhanced. The wildflower garden opposite the visitor center is at its best with all the spring blossoms. The Conservators' Bird Nesting Project constructs, maintains, and monitors over 36 nest boxes for cavity nesting species. These boxes provide homes for a variety of birds. This project works in conjunction with the Conservation Authority's Duck Box Program to provide nesting opportunities for a variety of birds, as well as shelter for other wildlife. Monitoring has shown that the use of the nest boxes routinely increases the nesting success of the species that utilize them, including tree swallows, bluebirds, and wood ducks. A memorial bench program will soon be made available to the public, which will provide visitors with comfortable resting places alongside Cooper Marsh trails. It will also provide an opportunity to pay tribute to the memory of someone special. The Legacy of Cooper Marsh booklet is now available through Cooper Marsh Conservators as well as via local retailers. These include Henderson's Grocery Store in Lancaster and Glengarry Fine Cheese just north of the village, as well as Home Hardware in Alexandria. This $15 publication recounts the legacy and natural history of Cooper Marsh. The book is authored by a series of individuals who have a wealth of knowledge and a great affection for the marsh and are keen to share their passion. The restoration and enhancement of Cooper Marsh is brought alive through stories and photographs of the marsh's unique flora and fauna. The first and second editions have been made available in English. A French edition will soon be available. If you would like more information about Cooper Marsh and the Conservators, visit the Raisin Region Conservation Authorities and Conservators websites, as well as the Cooper Marsh Conservators and RRCA pages on Facebook.
So thank you everyone for joining us on this self-guided driving tour of Glengarry. We really hope you've enjoyed it. On behalf of all the presenters and myself, we hope that you'll return to Glengarry and enjoy these sites again at your leisure. And if you keep in touch, send us an email. We can send you further updates as we do this in the future. Thanks so much.